Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Back in 1998, filmmaker Peter Weir made a film called The Truman Show about an individual who realizes his rather ordinary life is nothing more than an elaborate television reality show with actors and extras interacting in his daily life. Within a few years, psychiatrist Joel Gold began seeing Bellevue patients who claimed that they, like Truman Burbank, were being filmed constantly and broadcast around the world. Out of these patients suffering from what Gold called the Truman Show delusion, he began thinking about a larger question. How does culture or environment affect mental health? With his brother, psychiatrist and philosophy professor Ian Gold, they began seriously studying the environmental effects on mental illness and learned that our social world does play a role in history and today, along with genetics and brain chemistry and imbalances in the risk of psychosis. Childhood victimization, or the stress of being an immigrant or a child of one, raises your risk of psychotic illness. In fact, the larger the population of your home city, the higher the risk. Joel and Ian Gold are the authors of Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness, The Truman Show Delusion, and Other Strange Beliefs. It's published by the Free Press from Simon & Schuster. And in it, they offer a short history of psychiatry and how technology has fueled delusions in the past, and offers us some interesting questions about our current social world, complete with NSA revelations, constant surveillance, reality television, YouTube videos, Facebook, and cell phone technology. Joel Gold is a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the NYU School of Medicine, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Joel Gold, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your work with your brother Ian and this book examines a really interesting question, whether and how culture has an impact on mental health. And this decade-long investigation has made some very interesting insights. And it all begins with a patient you saw when you were at Bellevue named Albert, that you called Albert.
Yeah, Albert was a gentleman. I actually didn't know him for a very long time at Bellevue, but he came into my unit 2003 in October. And he believed that he was the center of a worldwide reality show wherein everybody was an actor, including his family, his friends, strangers in the street, and his treating team, including myself. We were all reading from the script. And he likened his life to the film The Truman Show. At the time, I didn't make too much of it because at Bellevue, psychiatric units, we see a lot of very unusual delusions. So, you know, I made a mental note, very curious and interesting, and moved on to the next handful of patients with a lot of strange ideas. But then I saw second and third and ultimately five men over the course of about 2 years, and they all, in some fashion, described their lives as reality television shows. Three of them mentioned The Truman Show by name, and so I began calling the phenomenon The Truman Show delusion.
Now, Albert was really interesting because he would tell you at one moment, you know, I may be totally crazy. And then the next moment he would say, you're absolutely an actor. You're not a doctor.
Yeah. Albert represents a certain cohort of patients, particularly those who are in the early stages of psychosis. So let's use schizophrenia as the sort of typical psychotic illness. In the very early stages when perhaps a young adult is developing schizophrenia, they're not quite there yet. We call it the prodromal phase, and they may not ultimately get there, but things start to feel a little bit odd to them. They're not quite sure, you know, what's real and what's not. And so someone like Albert, if we were to construe him as a person in the prodromal phase, they contain little snippets of reality testing. They are able to have what we call insight, stepping outside of themselves and saying, you know what, this is a little bit weird what I'm saying, but then slip back into the delusional belief system. And then when you get further into a full-blown psychotic episode, that insight is gone for good, and then people will tenaciously hold onto their beliefs.
Well, let's remember Albert as we go on, because I think he might provide some insights into what you've eventually found. But, so you found a number of patients that had this Truman Show delusion. What did you do?
Early on, my brother and I started thinking of it as a reflection of our culture, more in the sense of our entertainment culture, reality television, YouTube, and the like, the fact that someone with without any ostensible talent or beauty or the things that used to be associated with fame, now were no longer relevant. One could post themselves or upload a video of themselves onto YouTube and have a million people watch them. And what did that mean for the rest of us to watch this, particularly people who may be psychotic or on the brink of psychosis? They might think, well, gee, this person isn't terribly interesting, and yet they have a reality television show. Some people are famous essentially for being famous, you know, the Kim Kardashians of the world and, you know, the Paris Hiltons of the world. And so people might think, well, gee, if we're all watching her, you know, maybe people are watching me. And the Jim Carrey character in the Truman Show, Truman Burbank, he lives a fairly banal life. And so people might say, gee, I'm kind of boring. I don't know why people would want to watch me. But then again, you know, here are all these other folks. So initially it was much more about that. In more recent years, and I think much more powerfully, it became more about the surveillance society in which we live, the notion, not just the notion, the reality that we are being watched, that we are being listened to, that there are closed-circuit televisions all around, the government and corporations are collecting data about us, and of course that's, I think, concerning to many or most of us, if not all of us. But if you have a predilection, a risk for developing a psychotic illness, what impact does that have on your brain?
There's a wonderful line in the book. It says, you know, as we're writing this book, the goalposts kept moving of what is a rational fear and what's an irrational fear.
Absolutely. That's just it. When we first started writing the book, there was no real sense that the ideas about PRISM and the NSA, you know, they weren't even on the horizon. And suddenly we're in our fourth iteration of the manuscript, and then these things come to light, and we think, my goodness, when we first started writing the book, this would have been considered a persecutory paranoid delusion. And now, you know, what do you tell your patient with schizophrenia when they've been saying for years that the government is listening to my phone calls, and then, you know, they bring in the newspaper, and there it is on the front page. So that makes it much more difficult. I mean, who knows? You know, we say, I think somewhere in the book, you know, today's delusion is tomorrow's headline. And there is something to be said for that. It doesn't mean that these women and men aren't suffering from mental illness. It's not as though, you know, the people that have been getting these medications and have been in therapy for 20 years, you know, once we find out about, you know, these PRISM and Facebook experiments, that we just say, okay, well, I guess you're well, and, you know, sorry for the last 10 years of treatment. They have other symptoms that cause us to believe that they're suffering from a psychotic illness, but it definitely muddies the waters and can cause people to, you know, perhaps, you know, mistrust all the more the mental health system and question their doctors and be that much sort of less amenable to accepting treatment. So that's concerning in and of itself.
You know, the DSM definition of delusion basically says it's a strongly held belief that can't be shaken, I'm paraphrasing here, in mm-hmm. the face of evidence to the contrary. And there's a little...
When that evidence goes.
Yeah, you know the whole thing is, you know, okay, there are, 30 to 40% of the people, even though President Obama produced his birth certificate nearly 6 years ago, mm-hmm. that still believe he's born in Kenya. Yeah. And there was an interesting line. He says, you know, if you believe you've been abducted by a secret military organization and given brain-controlling drugs, that's a delusion. If you believe that others have done that...
It's not.
It's not.
It's exactly right. And that's, I mean, it is such a sort of malleable definition. In fact, the DSM, as you mentioned, the DSM-4, which we had been with for many years, actually called or defined delusions as fixed false beliefs. And they removed false from the definition, not in the light of the NSA revelations, but they've come to realize that a delusion doesn't have to be false. You can imagine, for instance, someone who believes that their spouse is being unfaithful, and they might believe it for some fairly bizarre reasons. You name it. The newscaster is wearing a blue tie, and my wife loves blue ties, and therefore they're having an affair, something, you know, quite bizarre. But that doesn't mean that the gentleman's wife is not cheating on him, right? Maybe not with the newscaster, but, you know, it doesn't mean that when he says, my wife is cheating on me, that he's wrong. And similarly, one can have this idea about the government, be psychotic and delusional, but not be wrong. I actually had a patient, I think I mentioned him in the book, before the Snowden story broke, about a month before, he came in and he said the NIA, what he called the National Intelligence Association, was hacking into his computer, and, you know, he had a lot of very paranoid ideas, including, you know, well, once he was on the hospital unit, that all of the other patients worked for Microsoft, and he had not slept for many days. And I was quite familiar with this man. I'd worked with him for a number of years, and he had a history of bipolar disorder and psychotic episodes. So I felt comfortable that he did need treatment. He was, you know, he was not well. But then the story breaks, and that aspect of his idea is actually true. So it becomes quite challenging. What do you tell someone, you know, when their delusion turns out to be the case? And it doesn't really help. You know, one would think, well, okay, great, you know, these people can feel that much better. But all it does is reinforce, you know, the notions that they had. And you know, it's I mean, there are all kinds of corrosive effects of you know, spying, government or otherwise. But, you know, this is certainly one of them.
And this gets to one of the big misconceptions you said you wanted to correct in this book, and perhaps the main one, that there's not a huge difference between the mentally ill and the mentally fit. He said there's it's a very small difference. And you use a case study, a patient named Donald, that illustrates this small difference. Tell us a little bit about Donald.
Yeah, Donald is a guy who, so he had a delusion, what we call a delusion of guilt, delusion of sin. And he became suicidal because he thought he had destroyed the world, essentially, due to his sinning. He had destroyed God, and he needed to be punished for his sins. And since he was waiting to be killed and it wasn't happening, he was going to take his own life. And he was ultimately hospitalized, and he was just going to starve himself to death until his colleagues, his friends on the inpatient unit, you know, after the doctors, we all failed, they convinced him not to give up and to eat, and ultimately he started getting a bit better and accepting treatment. But retrospectively, what came to light was that after his beloved wife had passed away, he had, you know, sex with another woman, and it turned out that it was Easter, and he was not even aware of it. He wasn't a particularly religious person. He didn't practice, but his late wife had, and so he was really come upon by this intense, intense guilt. But, you know, prior to that, he had been perfectly well. He, again, was, you know, happily married, had a career, and then, you know, he had this deep grief, which we're all capable of becoming depressed. It's one of the most common illnesses in the world, and people don't often understand that psychosis, the symptoms of psychosis, delusions, hallucinations, can be found in the context of severe depression. And so, you know, even if no one or someone, one of your listeners, has never been depressed before, it can certainly come on, and with that can come psychosis. You can think of any number of illnesses, medical or otherwise. You know, you and I are probably past the age where we're going to become schizophrenic, but we could have a medical illness, we could become delirious, we could have a brain injury. There are any numbers of ways people become demented, have Alzheimer's, and develop delusions. So it really is a fine line. It's not like, well, they're the crazy people on one side, and here we are, the healthy people on the other, and, you know, neither the twain shall meet. There are any number of stressors in life which can push people beyond the boundaries that they thought they could ever be pushed.
And that was what was most interesting. You said, just even as we understand more about the nature of mental illness and mental fitness today than we ever have, perhaps that divide between us and them is as pronounced or more pronounced than ever.
Yeah, that's something we've been struggling with. You know, when the genetic and biological explanations for mental illness first came to light or became, you know, the vogue for the last number of decades, you know, people at first embraced it because they felt, well, we won't be able to, you know, do what we've been doing mistakenly and blame families for the illness of their children, which unfortunately was the case for a long time. This phrase, the schizophrenogenic mother, this idea that cold mothers, intrusive and invasive and again, unloving mothers primarily and families in general would actually cause their children to become schizophrenic, which, you know, is obviously an odious and false idea. And so, you know, if someone says, well, schizophrenia is a genetic disease, so no worries there. But then really that becomes the line. You know, I have good genes, you have bad genes. I have a good brain, you have a bad brain. And there we go. There's the divide. But when you take the environment into account, well, we all live in this society. And, you know, it's not just good gene, bad gene. There are any number of biological factors that are at play and any number of environmental ones. And when you bring genetics and the environment together, as Darwin suggested that we should, you realize that it's a much grayer line.
My guest today is Joel Gold, a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at New York University School of Medicine. He and his brother, Ian Gold, are co-authors of Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness, The Truman Show Delusion and Other Strange Beliefs, and is our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, following up on that, one of the things you write in this, trying to understand the nature of delusion, you write that a lot of the current thought is involved in the chemistry, the genetics, the neuroscience involved in mental illness and not the environment. Environment is taking a back seat at this point, or is it?
Well, unfortunately, we think it is. When you think of the way that the National Institutes of Mental Health, you know, think about it and aspire to psychiatry as essentially being brain illness, all of the monies that are granted to researchers are essentially monies to research the brain and genes. And we think that that's a huge disservice to our patients and to the field itself. There are any number of well-established findings that the environment does count when it comes to psychosis. For instance, if one lives in an urban environment rather than in a more rural environment, one is at higher risk for developing schizophrenia. If one is an immigrant, same thing. If one has been abused in childhood, and that includes bullying, which has been in the news a lot recently, then so too is one at higher risk. And this is not, you know, a small difference. Sometimes it's 2, 3, 4 times the risk of developing schizophrenia later in life. So that's kind of amazing when you think of it. And, you know, the way I tend to think of it of late is if you were to tell a cancer researcher, well, you know, we're just looking at the lungs of people, so don't really bother too much about smoking. You know, someone smokes or they don't. That's not really that important. That would be a crazy idea, right? Who would ever think such a thing? And yet, for the most part, and I don't want to paint every psychiatrist with a broad brush. Some people do take the environment into account, but I think the researchers, at least for the most part, at least in this country, much less so. In the United Kingdom, there's more of this research, and the rest of Europe, the numbers that I stated or the factors that I stated in terms of child abuse, immigration, and urbanicity, much more in Europe, these findings, and they're only slowly coming to light in the U.S. And when you think about what we're describing with technology and the like, well, if those factors can, in some sense, contribute to the development of psychosis, why not these other technological factors? If living in an enormous city puts one at risk, well, what about the city that we live in on the internet? In some sense, it's the largest city we've ever lived in, even if it's not, you know, a bricks and mortar kind of city.
Very interesting thing about this book is you give us almost like a layperson's history of psychiatry and then a history of what we've learned about delusions. And one of the things you says is really difficult for, you know, somebody who's never experienced delusions to understand is what a delusion feels like.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing when one thinks of it. You know, we all believe what we believe. And if you imagine pretty much any thought that you have, and, you know, we take it pretty much at face value. Obviously, there are some things, you know, we don't know who's going to win the game tomorrow, but, you know, we have some sense of what is and what is not. And if someone were to, you know, walk up to you and say, well, you know, you think you're living in Tulsa, but but you're not. You know, for some reason you think you are, but really, you know, this is Belgium. And you said, no, this is Tulsa. I don't understand what you're talking about. This is crazy. And they say, no, you're the crazy one. Imagine that experience, right? Something that you know in your brain, in your heart, in your every cell in your body to be true is not. And that's kind of the experience that people with delusions have. They don't walk around thinking, oh, yeah, I have this crazy thought, and other people don't. They think the opposite. I am well, I am sane, and for some reason, no one believes me. And again, this is somewhat the theme of The Truman Show, the film, and I think it's a really great description of the experience that people have. And you can come up with thought experiments, as I sort of just tried to do on the fly, but it's really it's painful. It's a really painful experience. It's not the sense of, you know, oh, silly thoughts that people, you know, hold on to. Again, we have superstitions, and we might know that, again, you know, whatever, wearing our baseball cap backwards, you know, we think in the moment, oh, that might help, you know, our team rally to win, but we kind of know that that's not really the case, and we don't call that a delusion because so many people feel it. But, you know, if you really dig beneath the surface, people are able to give that up and say, okay, yeah, I kind of know that that's not the case, but, you know, part of me thinks it's you know, it's my lucky shirt or you know, what have you. But there is a difference between that and these much greater ones, and the severity or the intensity. It's one thing, again, to have a superstition, you know, don't step on a crack in the road. It's another to think, you know, I am Jesus, come back. You know, it obviously is going to have a much greater impact on one's life.
Now, the book is titled Suspicious Minds, and this gets at the heart of what you say, shape the delusions, that as a part of our biological evolutionary makeup, we have a suspicion system that makes us wary. If you're walking, say, in a jungle, you're very suspicious. If you're walking on a dark path on a sidewalk with only one light down the road, you have that suspicion. And what you say, what happens in I think your thought is in people who are suffering from delusions, that suspicion system sort of overrides the other systems that are there.
Exactly right.
The reflective system that says...
Very described. That's essentially exactly what we're saying. We think that it's important that we have this aspect of our brains. We just call it the suspicion system. We don't, you know, we're not saying it's this actual anatomical part of the brain, but we think that over the course of time, our brains have evolved to negotiate the social world and particularly the malign intentions of others. It would be obviously evolutionarily in our interest to know that, you know, there may be a tiger that wants to attack us or that the person down the dark alley may want to mug us or not. And it's important to err perhaps on the side of caution, but if we always err on the side of caution, then bad things tend to happen. If every time you saw a stranger, you thought they were going to attack you, you wouldn't get very far in life, and you would be, you know, very, very distressed. So the idea of the suspicion system is it's a kind of alarm meant to detect the, again, these harmful intentions that others might have, and then that's the fight or flight response, so to speak. We then believe, as you suggest, this reflective system where in a moment we think a tiger is coming, and then we take a quick second and we, you know, survey our environment. We say, no, it's just the wind and a branch, you know, cracked, and we can, you know, our heart rate slows down a little bit and we continue our walk. But if the suspicion system is broken in some fashion, or the connection between the reflective system and the suspicion system is interrupted, then we're all sort of flying by the suspicion system, and then it's not overridden. It's like the brakes are taken off, and that first thought that, you know, the tiger is going to eat me stays with us, and then we come into these very, what, you know, turn out to be delusional ideas that people are trying to harm us in some fashion, and we act, you know, in response to that when we ought not to.
There's an interesting chart in there that shows a variety of cultures, and the persecutory delusion is probably the most common one in cultures everywhere around the world. And
absolutely,
it's interesting, factors move around below that, but persecutory is always number one.
Yeah, and again, you know, in the context of what I was describing, it would make good sense that, you know, the most common harm that might come to us is just that, right? Someone is trying to take my property or physically harm me, you know, or poison me, or any of the things that might put my life or health at risk. And over the course of time, again, evolutionarily, that's the number one thing, is to survive. So it makes sense that if we are fearful and careful, again, it's not always a negative thing. We, you know, there are people out there who, you know, would like to take our stuff. And if you think about, you know, over the course of history, I mean, that often involved, you know, literally our lives. So it would make sense then, when the suspicion system kind of went out of control, that persecution paranoia would be the number one concern that people would have, regardless of the time in history or the culture, the country one lives in. That's kind of the big daddy. And then down the line, depending on what time in history and what culture one lives in, the other kinds of delusions may shift around a little bit.
Well, it's a really interesting book. One of the things you try to do is get a sense of what delusion feels like. And going back to that idea that Albert had and that you write as this misconception, there's not a big difference between the mentally ill and the mentally fit. You tell a story of what a delusion feels like when you were coming back on a international plane flight. You're waiting in customs.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, for those individuals that were that relationship between fit and ill is fraying. It's a
Absolutely.
very telling
it
remark.
Was,
tell us the story.
It was really an amazing experience. If we have the time, I can very briefly suggest that I was coming back into the country, and I was making sort of wisecracks to my family about how slow it was all going, and I pointed out a particular security official who was sort of standing around with his hands in his pockets, and I whispered it in such a way that literally the man in front of me could not hear me. And I actually asked him afterwards, and he said, "No, I didn't hear what you were talking about." When we got to the front, we were pulled out of line, and they started going through our possessions. They said, "Oh, it's a routine check." And then my child started to cry, and the patrol officer turned to her and said, "Oh, well, you know, your dad doesn't think that we're working hard enough. You know, we'll show him." And it was terrifying. I mean, my heart dropped, and I felt, you know, how did they hear that? And, you know, am I being watched? Am I on some watch list now? And for a while, I mean, it's still to this day, it stayed with me. What about the next time I enter the country? You know, are they going to pull me out of line again? Are they going to harass me because I'd made these sarcastic comments? And so in that respect, I think for a moment, I really did experience what it might feel like for someone to feel persecuted.
And it turns out they have it. Everything might.
Yeah, they did. When I got to the gate, I recounted the story to one of the airplane workers, and she said, "Oh yeah, there. Once you get into the security area, there are secret mics all over the place," which wasn't actually that surprising in retrospect. But you know, when you're just standing in line there, you don't really think much of it, and then you think, "Wow, they really are listening." It's kind of terrifying.
Do you think that, you know, the new surveillance society, the disclosures of the NSA, reality television, YouTube videos, Facebook, cell phones, ubiquitous technology, is this having an effect?
I can't imagine that it's not.
All right. Well, Joel Gold, thank you very much for joining us.
Great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Joel Gold is an associate professor of psychiatry at the NYU School of Medicine and co-author with his brother of Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.